Good evening, everyone, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Lenny Mendoza, Director Emeritus of McKinsey & Company, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Directors, and your moderator for today's program. It's my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Anya Manuel, former State Department official and author of this terrific new book, This Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. I'll give you a little bit of background on Ms. Manuel. From 2005 to 2007, she served as Special Assistant to U.S. Undersecretary for Political Affairs, Nicholas Burns, at the Department of State. In this role, she had responsibility for South Asia policy, congressional outreach, and legal matters. She was part of the negotiating team for the U.S.-India Civilian Nuclear Accord, helped secure passage of the accord in the U.S. Congress, and was extensively involved in the U.S. policy towards Afghanistan and Pakistan. Ms. Manuel is also the co-founder and partner, along with former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, former National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, and former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, of Rice Hadley Gates, LLC, a strategic consulting firm. Their firm assists CEOs and senior executives at major companies, many of them headquartered in California, to export, expand their businesses, meet regulatory challenges in key emerging markets like China, India, Latin America, and the Middle East. Ms. Manuel is also a lecturer at International Policy Studies Program at Stanford, where she designs and teaches a course on U.S. foreign policy in Asia. She graduated cum laude from Harvard Law School, holds a BA and MA degree with distinction from Stanford University. Please join me in welcoming Anya Manuel. Well, we're delighted today to be able to have a conversation with you about your new book, This Brave New World, which I must say, I just loved the title. It, as an Aldo Huxley fan, being able to think of a brave new world as not dystopian, but talking about ways that we might be able to think about a new world order is really a fascinating conversation. And I'm not the only one who thought this book was really interesting. There was a fantastic review in the San Francisco Chronicle by Jane Wales, who is the CEO of the World Affairs Council and the former Senior Director of National Security for the Science and Technology Council. And she said, among other things, there are many books about Asia with a narrow focus and perhaps more detail, but readers looking for an astute, fast-paced overview should not miss This Brave New World. And I think you'll see during the course of this evening that she was right in terms of Ms. Manuel's perspective on the world and a very interesting view in particular on India and China. So with that, let's start the conversation. We're in the middle of a complicated political season when most people are talking about domestic affairs.
That's right.
But we should be paying attention to China and India. And why should we do that? And why is it in our interest to get along with them?
Sure. Lenny, first of all, thank you very much for that incredibly kind introduction about me and about the book and to the Commonwealth Club for hosting me. Why should we pay attention to India and China? They are already now and will in the next decade have a dramatic impact on all of us here in the United States. So by 2030, they will be the largest market for our companies outside the US. They will have 3 billion people between them, 100 million more in India than in China, and they will be the world's largest middle classes. So we will be selling to them. We used to think that we could solve the world's biggest problems if the US and Europe managed to get it just about right. That's no longer the case. If you take climate change, for example, China is already the largest carbon emitter. We all live here in San Francisco. 20% of your smog here actually comes directly from Asia. It's not even created here. India is not the largest emitter, but it's the fastest growing. So we can't even think about solving these problems without getting these two giants on board. And finally, the military situation in Asia is getting much less stable and more difficult. Unlike in Europe, where you have NATO, where you have a real security architecture, in Asia, of course, there is none. Almost 50% of arms imports around the world go to Asia. many of those right now to China and India, who are both increasing their defense expenditure very rapidly year over year. So this is going to impact all of us. And when I see the candidates and when I see our press, our public discourse, other than in august groups like this one, we talk a lot about China. And we seem really worried about it. And we don't quite know what to think. So one day they're out there and they're 10 feet tall and they're coming to get us. And the next day the headlines are they're the doomed dragon and five signs of the Chinese economic apocalypse. We can't quite decide what we think of them. India is not very much in our news. You could be forgiven for not knowing that Prime Minister Modi is in the United States this week. He gave an address to a joint session of Congress, which is a very big honor for a foreign leader. Barely made the press. So these are two countries that are going to have enormous impact on us, and that's why I think we need to pay attention.
Okay. Before we get into the today's world about what's going on with China and India in particular, can you talk a little bit about history and how history has influenced how India and China act on the world stage today?
Yes, and China and India actually have somewhat similar histories. So these are two great ancient civilizations. They were the largest economies on Earth for nearly 2,000 years, until about 1500, 1600, when Europe started growing and taking over. And then both countries had very negative experiences with the European powers. India, of course, was run as a colonial power by the British. China had the era of the unequal treaties, where a number of foreign countries, including Europeans and also the Japanese, took over bits and ports of China and really treated them pretty unfairly. Both countries came into being in their current state not until the late 1940s. So it's very recent. But what's interesting is that they have reacted very differently to these shared histories. China seems bent on going back to the center of the stage in the world where they believe they belong. They think they're the Middle Kingdom, and they are determined to get back there. I don't know, I'm sure many of you have been to Beijing, but there is a beautiful exhibition at the National Museum, and it's called The Road to Revival. It's all about the shame and overcoming the shame of their past and going back to center stage where they think they belong. India treated it completely differently. So when it became independent in 1947, its first prime minister, Nehru, said, we are going to be the representative of the downtrodden of the world. We're going to speak for the rest of the developing world, and we're not going to take sides in great power conflicts. And that's really how India saw itself. And that's why sometimes you see India being a little bit more reticent on the world stage. They're coming out of that now with Modi, who's pretty assertive. But I think that makes a big difference in how you see them acting worldwide.
Okay. One of the things I loved about your book is that you're not just talking about this at a policy and theoretical level, but you're talking about your experience on the ground, walking and engaging in the slums of Delhi or the factory towns in China. Talk a little bit about what it's like there on the ground, and talk a little bit in particular about the issues of income inequality in that context.
Thank you. Yes, one of my favorite things about researching and writing this book is that I got to explore the parts of India and China that I don't normally see. So when you're in the government, you go over and you sit in big conference rooms and you meet with other government officials. Now I go and I meet with business leaders. And I intentionally, when I researched this book, spent time with the folks that are usually invisible, even if those of us who've traveled there. So I spent some time in the slums of Delhi and tried to do a lot of interviews in some electronics factories in China. I was not permitted to do that, but there was a very nice grad student at Stanford who helped me with that and showed me her videos and her interviews, but just shows how the two countries react differently and how open or closed they are. Here's the dramatic difference. Both countries still have a big challenge with poverty. It's, of course, much bigger in India than in China. So in India, 300 million people still live under the World Bank poverty line, and that poverty line is $1.25 a day. So they live on nothing. Urban poverty in India is just like the pictures you've seen. When in the slum that I spent a week in, people live in corrugated iron huts. They have no electricity. They have no plumbing. The streets are actually surprisingly clean because people are very proud and they sweep them and they take care of their little neighborhood. And it's a really solid community, but a very poor community. And they make their living by every day climbing a trash heap that is 3 football fields high and gathering the recyclables and selling the recyclables to recyclers. That is how they make their money. So they're not in the formal sector. This becomes important in a minute. In China, there is still a lot of rural poverty, but it's only 84 million people who live under the poverty line. So the dimensions are a little bit different. And urban poverty looks very different. So if you look at the big electronics factories that are assembling the iPhone or the tablet that's probably in your pocket right now, people live in dorms, maybe 8 to a room or even 16 to a room. It's not particularly comfortable, but there is heat in the winter. There is electricity. There is plumbing. There is a recreation room with a ping pong table. There are little shops outside that sell noodles. So it's an uncomfortable life, but it is not destitute poverty in the same way that you have it in India. And they work at businesses that are registered. And this becomes very important in a way that I didn't realize before I did the research for the book. The Chinese poor are in the formal sector. So they don't always get perfect pensions and health care and maternity leave, but that is possible to give them through their paychecks, just like it happens here. They're known to the state, and the state can help them, and the state is starting to try to really help them. In India, until recently, you didn't even know that these people existed, right? You couldn't count them. There's no social security system in the way that there is here in the U.S. And just about 5 years ago, India changed that pretty dramatically. One of the big internet entrepreneurs, Nandan Nilekani, went to the Indian government and said, I will take my 100 best engineers and I'm going to create a first-rate biometric ID system for India. This is better than anything you've seen in the U.S. So now any Indian who wants to voluntarily goes and signs up, gets 10 fingerprints done, 2 iris scans done, and then they have a biometric ID that's linked to a number, like your social security number, called Aadhaar. And now, for the first time, these people can be found. And Modi doubled down on this, the new prime minister, and said, now that we can find all these people, we're going to create bank accounts for them. So in 5 years, over 1 billion Indians have signed up for this. Pretty amazing. And Modi has opened over 220 million bank accounts. So where you used to go in the slums and you'd hand out, you know, a little free grain and a little free kerosene and half of it would disappear through graft, now people can take their smartphones or go to the corner store, put in their fingerprints and say, oh, we're owed 500 rupees in pensions, and the rupees go straight into their bank account. So they're starting to solve the problem in a pretty interesting, uniquely Indian way, but they've got a long, long way to go.
Okay. Continuing on what's going on in India, you recently wrote a New York Times op-ed on corruption in India. You want to talk a little bit about that and compare it to what is also in the headlines about corruption in China? Is it substantial as we hear? Is anything being done about it? How do you think about that?
Yeah, it is very substantial. And when I was a young State Department employee, and apparently very naive, a mid-level official in one of the ministries in India actually tried to involve me in a kickback scheme. And I sort of didn't understand what he was talking about. He said, oh, I'm planning this conference, and I'm going to pay you to plan the conference, which, you know, you can't do that if you're a U.S. government official. You can't even accept a pizza from somebody. And he said, and then you just give me some of the money back. And I was so flabbergasted, I just sort of sat there blinking that he gave up pretty quickly. But it just shows you that no one is immune. And this happens. It happens absolutely everywhere in India and everywhere in China, as in many other parts of the world. So the Chinese anti-corruption campaign, I'm sure you've all read and heard about, very dramatic, very much in the news. And it has been As you would expect from an authoritarian regime, it's been all top-down. So Wang Shishan, who's the anti-corruption czar, who's very pro-Western, very smart guy, when you meet with him now, he wears not Western dress, but traditional Chinese dress, and he hardens visibly when he talks about corruption. And he says, we are doing this anti-corruption campaign to purify the Communist Party so it can rule for another 100 years. So this is about the purity of the party and the longevity of the party. Nothing else, nothing more or less. So that's the Chinese side, and I'll get back to whether that's working or not in a minute. The Indian side is, it's a democracy. Power is much more dispersed, and these types of things happen really bottom up. So 10 years ago when I was in the government, I told the story. No one would take you seriously when you said something about corruption. People would just pretend it wasn't happening. 5 or 6 years ago, a gentleman named Anna Hazare, who is sort of older and bespectacled, looks a little bit like Gandhi, had finally had enough. And he went on a hunger strike, and he started a minor revolution. So thousands and then tens of thousands of Indians followed him, and people went out in the street and said, enough is enough. We don't want to do this anymore. We're done with this. And he didn't get all of the reforms through that he wanted. He wanted an independent entity, like an independent ombudsman, to try corruption cases quickly. He didn't quite get that, but he got some of the reforms, and he got people to wake up. And it was part of the reason that the previous government, the Manmohan Singh government, was voted out of office, and the Modi government was voted in, promising clean governance. Now, the Modi government has been, by all accounts, a little bit better. So there used to be a very cozy relationship between big business in India and the government. From what I hear out of Delhi, that has disappeared a little bit. They have to get in line just like everybody else. A lot of licenses have been put online. The biometric ID program that I talked about has made a huge difference in rooting out graft kind of at the bottom level, like the low-level official that was stealing half of people's pensions or half of the free grain that they were getting. So in India, all bottom-up. In China, all top-down. The problem is neither of these are really perfect. So if you, before I started the firm that I now have, I was a lawyer and did a lot of anti-corruption work around the world. The few countries that have actually done this right, South Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, a few others, have done a number of things. They arrest the bad guys at the top, sort of like what China is doing, but they try them in independent courts and very quickly. So no one really thinks that the Chinese crackdown is that independent. It's a little bit politically motivated. They also do a lot of education, starting with K through 12 education, about what it means to be ethical in society. That isn't happening either in India or in China. And in some cases, they also raise the salaries of lower level government workers to make it less desirable to take bribes, and that isn't happening either. So both of these countries still have they're starting in different ways, but they both still have a long, long way to go.
Okay. In addition to cracking down on corruption, China feels like it's cracking down on dissent more aggressively as well these days. How are they managing that, and is that the beginning of a concern about instability in society as they try and ensure that there's no alternative opinion?
Yeah. We'll get asked this a lot by clients because, of course, everybody wants to see into the future. And what my business partner, Condi, always says is she was a Soviet scholar and absolutely not one person saw the fall of the Soviet Union coming. So these systems are so opaque that you will not be able to predict if there is going to be a coup or a fall of the regime in China. But let me give you some data points in what the intel community we would call chatter. And there is a lot of chatter. So in March, an anonymous letter was made public in Beijing that called for President Xi to step down because they said he's creating a cult of personality. He has taken too much power on himself, and it actually threatened his life. That's pretty unprecedented in the Chinese system where it's all about saving face and publicly expressing the same opinions. There is a lot of rumors, not proven, but there are a lot of rumors that there have been attempts on the life of both Xi Jinping and of the anti-corruption czar Wang Qishan. Whether that means that the regime will fall is anyone's guess. But I do think it's more likely that if there is a change in China, it will come from within the party system. So other elites within the party will say they've had enough with this anti-corruption campaign and enough with Xi because he's moving very quickly on some reforms, and not in a big Tiananmen Square-style uprising like you saw 25 years ago. When I go to China now, I'm always surprised at how much dissent there actually is and the different forms that it takes. So I think mostly what you hear about here is when a big human rights advocate there is jailed or flees to our embassy, as happened a couple of years ago. And of course, there are those people. But most of the day-to-day protests, over 180,000 of them by a Chinese estimate, not even an American estimate, these protests, 180,000 protests a year, most of them are about bread and butter issues. You took my land without paying me enough compensation. I'm not getting paid enough at this factory. The environment is terrible and I can't breathe this air. That's the kind of stuff that people are protesting about. And mostly the Chinese government actually tries to fix it, right? And they crack down a little bit, but mostly they try to solve those problems for their citizens. That's one. Two are people who are on the outside of the majority in China and who always will be. So Tibetans, Uyghurs, Christians to some extent. And those, the crackdown has been really, really tough. More than, frankly, most people expected from Xi. And finally, and what I find the most interesting, is that the group of millennials that is now coming up in China is probably more irreverent than my millennial students here at Stanford. So when I go to China and give talks to students there, their questions are just as outspoken as any question you would get here. I was there a little while ago, and my government-hired translator, I was talking to her about social media, and she said, well, we know it's all censored, but we keep switching platforms when a new one comes out because we know the censors aren't up to it yet. And so we could say whatever we want. I thought, that's pretty bold coming from the government translator, right? And then finally, the internet is just so fast that even though China has 3 million people censoring the internet, that's how many people they're employing on internet censorship, they just can't keep up. So there's a Chinese gentleman who actually teaches at Berkeley who has an algorithm that monitors what's happening on Chinese social media. And some of the stuff is just astounding. So when the National Congress happens every spring, there were lots of remarks, trending remarks, such as, who are these people and who elected them? And I don't think they represent me. Now that's pretty serious. And this generation has no memory of Tiananmen Square. They were born after 1989, so they have no real memory of crackdown. So this is what I see as one big trend that might change the government of China in the future, and the other is an internal dissatisfaction.
Sounds like we ought to be watching that space more than we're watching Trump's Twitter feeds. But
I think so.
I want to come back to India for a minute, and you said in the book that India is one of the worst democracies in the world to be a woman. Is that true, and is it worse in India than in China?
It is true, and it is worse in India than in China. It's interesting, on some measures, so India has this beautiful constitution that's actually modeled in large part on our constitution. All of the minority and women's rights are in place, and they're enshrined in law. So the law is actually pretty good, better maternity leave than here, for example, as does China. We're down there somewhere with Papua New Guinea in our maternity leave. But the problem is, if you are poor or of lower caste, those laws don't tend to be enforced in your favor. And this is another beautiful the Indian story. There was a group of lower caste village women, and battering of women, domestic violence, is a particular problem in India. It's really pretty egregious. And there was a group of women who finally had enough. And so now they call themselves the Gulabi Gang. There are now thousands of them all over India. And whenever there is an allegation that someone is beating their wife, they dress up in hot pink saris, and they take sticks and clubs, and they go beat the guy up. It's pretty great. And they'll also do things like mediate dowry disputes because the police refuses to get involved. So it's just a very Indian story. But overall, the police is overtaxed and doesn't really get involved as much as they should. Also, when you look at women in the workforce, in India, I think it's something only like 25 to 28% of women work outside the home. In the US, it's more like 58%. In China, it's 70%. So China, the Communist Party, was actually very good for women's rights, including there were women who fought their way out of the bush with Mao in the 1940s. The one area where women are kind of underrepresented in China is in politics, but in business, they are right there at the very top. There is something, I hope I'm getting the statistics right, but I think there are 3 million Chinese women-run companies, 3 million Chinese women entrepreneurs running sometimes pretty large companies. More self-made female billionaires in China than anywhere else on Earth. So women are, there are issues there, just like there are in the U.S., but women are by and large doing fairly well in China.
Okay. I've got a couple more questions for you, and then I have a whole stack of questions from the audience that I'm going to get to in a minute. Great. But let's talk a little bit about security. You talked in your book about the scuffles between Chinese and Indian soldiers on the Himalayan border. Is that for theater, or is there a chance of some real conflict there, and is that something we should be worried about, or is it something that is just on the side and we really ought to be talking and thinking a lot more about what's going on in the South China Sea?
We should monitor carefully what's going on between India and China, because although every time they get together they proclaim that their friendship goes back thousands of years and Buddhism came from India and moved into China. There are all these standard, they both suffered at the hands of the West. Really, they're worried about each other. And especially the Indians are increasingly worried about China in the same way that we are. So they want to get along with China economically, just like we do. It's a huge trading partner. But China is increasingly being assertive and pushing its power south and west and into India's traditional sphere of influence. And the scuffles you talk about, I write about them in the book. You should actually all look it up on YouTube. It's actually pretty funny. There are videos of Chinese and Indian soldiers going across what is a really long disputed border in the High Himalayas that was drawn by a hapless British bureaucrat and nobody quite knows where the lines are. In 1962, China and India fought a big war over that border and the Chinese just dominated. So India lost very quickly and spectacularly. So the Indians are worried. So far, no one has been allowed to shoot at each other, but you can see these videos of people kind of throwing punches. Everyone has their iPhones out to take videos of it and then put it up on YouTube. And this happened most recently just as Xi and Modi were standing at the podium in Delhi giving a joint speech. So it's happening everywhere. I think what worries the Indian military more than those scuffles, which are manageable, is that Chinese submarines are increasingly active in the Indian Ocean. And as one Indian admiral put it to me, they're sneaking very close to our coasts in a way that makes India nervous. And that is one of the factors that is making the partnership between India and the United States so much closer. So they're worried. I think it's more something to monitor than something where we think a war is going to break out tomorrow.
Okay. One last question, and then we'll go to the audience. You talked earlier in your remarks about the environment and China being the largest emitter of carbon and India the fastest growing. That obviously has a direct impact on the U.S. as well as the global environment. What if anything, can we do together on that topic, or is it just fundamentally we're going to be at a different perspective, given that they view the U.S. as already a problem, and you know, don't tell us we can't admit because you already did.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the best opportunities for us to cooperate with both China and India. And in the book, I write about the different challenges that both of these countries face. We've talked about some of them, the environment, women, how to manage dissent, income inequality. And in each chapter, I think through what can we do to actually cooperate with these two great powers? Because of course, we will have differences. But ultimately, to benefit all of us here in this room, we're going to have to find a way to get along. Nobody wants a new Cold War. If you take the trajectory all the way in the Trump direction, you're not on a very good trajectory. So, and I think actually the work we've done with both countries on climate change is some of the most promising. So to give you an idea of the problem, if you go to a Chinese coal mine, it is just staggering in size. It's gray and 30 football fields in length, and you have those huge trucks where the wheel is bigger than a human. They look tiny, like toys in the distance, and you just sort of feel, oh my gosh, the Chinese are going to do whatever it takes to keep growth going. But actually, the picture is much more mixed. They're doing a huge amount on clean energy. So China last year invested $110 billion in clean technologies. The U.S. invested about half that, $56 billion. India was way behind at $15 billion. So China is actually really taking this seriously. Their citizens are very active on these issues, and they are, in my view, legitimately trying to clean up their act. India is a little farther behind. So 13 of the 20 most polluted cities on Earth are actually in India, not in China. Fewer people talk about it because people still are worried more about growth than they are about the environment, but that's shifting slowly. When you look at, I spent some time on the Ganges River, the holy Ganges rivers in Varanasi, where many Indians, devout Hindus go to die and be cremated. And we're on a boat and there's pilgrims bathing, there's cows defecating in the water, and there is a corpse floating by. So, you know, they've got work to do. They've got a lot of work to do. And you talked about what we can do together. When I was in the government, I was one of the negotiators, as you said, of the civilian nuclear deal with India, which is finally being implemented as of yesterday. It only took 10 years. Yeah. But one of the reasons that I was so in favor of the deal, which is a little bit controversial because it allows India to have civilian nuclear reactors, and for us to help build those civilian nuclear reactors, and this all happened, of course, before Fukushima, is that this is a huge carbon savings. So the Indians have these really optimistic projections about how many nuclear reactors they are going to build. If you divide those in three, you're still saving more CO2 emissions through the Indian Civ Nuke deal alone than the Kyoto Protocol did in all of Europe. So the scale is just so big that you're not going to get there by lecturing. You're going to get there by working with people. And just like I think the India Civ Nuke deal was a really positive thing, the deal that John Podesta and Todd Stern and President Obama negotiated with China at the end of 2014 for China and the U.S. to both slowly lower their carbon emissions is fantastic. And that's exactly the kind of work we should be doing.
Okay. I'm going to now go to some of the questions we got from the audience, and one of them was very related to what you were just talking about around India and the environmental issues. So there was an important set of steps that have been taken to build some collaboration to ensure that India is moving forward on some of those, but India is still a major coal user. So what, if anything, can the U.S. do to help India reduce its reliance on coal in a way that would not hurt their economy but help ensure that they're making more progress on environmental issues?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and it puts India really in a bind because they use a lot of coal. The coal they have in India is very dirty coal with a lot of byproducts that are unhealthy, burns very dirty, and they've been very inefficient at getting it out of the ground. So the problem is, to get enough electricity and to keep the growth going for your 300 million people that are still living under the poverty line, you gotta do some electricity with coal. And this is what the energy minister says, sighing every time you talk to him about it. So they're gonna get more efficient at getting their coal out of the ground. That's, of course, a big problem for us. At the same time, Prime Minister Modi and his whole team are actually, I believe, legitimately committed to renewables. A bunch of Indian ministers were here at Stanford last week. We had a long conversation about this. And their plan is to build 100 gigawatts of solar within the next 15 years. That's a lot. Even if they don't, that's like 100 coal plants, 100 giant coal plants worth of solar power. So that's good. If they'll get all the way there, you're not sure. The U.S. can help, and we're already helping. My husband works with a lot of clean technology companies. They're all trying to do business in China and in India. There are a lot of U.S. government announcements on clean tech initiatives with India, and I would say respectfully, it's peanuts. You know, just now when Obama and Modi were together, they announced something like 60 million for this clean tech project and 40 million for this joint clean tech project. And that's fine, but that's not where the big shift is going to come. The big shift is going to be in helping India think through the big issues, allowing them to have nuclear power as a base load, helping them think through how to do finance. Some of this stuff gets really boring and esoteric, but it's important. Helping them think through how do you do financing for massive scale solar, because right now that's very expensive. So those are the kinds of areas where we can help, and actually where businesses and all of us can help, and it doesn't necessarily have to be government to government.
Okay. There were a couple questions about food and food security. And what do you have any thoughts on the outlook for food security or any risks there in China or India?
Mm-hmm. China is doing just fine on food security, although they are importing a lot, including from Africa. And the reason they have to import so much is because they have no water. So to the extent that there is food insecurity in China, it stems from a lack of water. Almost all of their big rivers originate in the Himalayas on the Tibetan plateau, and they flow north. And as you get farther north into China, there is just no water left. This, by the way, also concerns the Indians, because occasionally the Chinese talk about things like they're going to divert the Brahmaputra River, which currently turns and flows into India, and the Chinese want to divert it to flow the other way into China. That might be a reason to go to war. But so for now, there's no real food insecurity in China. If you've got another 10 years of droughts, and they have struggle with imports and things, it's a problem. In India, there is sometimes food insecurity, but a lot of it comes through the inefficiencies that are in the system. So farmers are allowed to pump a lot of water for free. They get subsidized diesel to run the pumps, to pump the water out of the ground. A lot of the agriculture is very inefficient. There is no cold storage to transport food across Indian states. The tax system between the states is different. So it's like you're trying to bring onions from California to Nevada, and you've got to stop your truck at the border for 5 days to pay the taxes, right? It's that kind of stuff that makes it inefficient. So occasionally, like 6 or 7 years ago, they actually had a big spike of inflation, especially on food prices. And since so many people are living so close to the poverty line, having your onions cost twice as much or your lentils cost twice as much are a big problem. But you haven't seen any real famines, big famines in India since the end of colonialism, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Good. This is an unfortunate part of the food chain in China, but a very specific question from someone. Do you hear anything about politicians in China acting seriously on ending the dog meat trade?
Oh. I do not know anything about the dog meat trade in China. I'm sorry.
No, I had to give you one tough question, but it was an audience question, so it was a legitimate
question. We'll find out.
Okay, so... there was a set of questions here around how do we help U.S. citizens understand and engage more in why China and India are important.
Yeah. Well, I wrote the book in part because I find this so important. And, you know, there is a lot of engagement. So many of our Silicon Valley companies, the first place, I mean, they'll start here, then they'll do a little Europe, but very quickly they're thinking about China and India as a big market. Many of us are doing business there. Many of us travel there. But we don't know a lot of the context of these countries and what makes them tick. And that's actually one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. It's sort of for, with you in mind, or with my clients, or with my husband in mind. And I do think we need to do a lot more to understand both of them, especially China. Because I think India, there is this underlying comfort. You know, I start the book actually with two stories. Last September, within 5 days, President Xi was here and did a big dinner for the business community in Seattle. And then Modi was here a few days later and did a similar dinner here in Silicon Valley. And I was lucky enough to be at both. And the Chinese dinner was so formal. It was an hour and a half in a security line, and they had seated, other than the head table, the Chinese and the Americans were mostly seated separately. There wasn't a lot of interaction. And Xi's speech was very formal. It was about, we're going to have to try to get along, and we're working hard to make this work. But underneath, there's a lot of discomfort. Then fast forward to India a couple days later. Modi's an hour and a half late. No one knows who's Indian, who's American, who's Indian-American. There are five CEOs, American CEOs on stage. Three of them were actually born in India, right? Microsoft, Google, Adobe, a bunch of others of our iconic countries, companies are run by Indian-Americans. So there's just this underlying comfort with India that you don't have with China. But there is a lot we all can do, and I talk about a lot of it in the book. A lot of it is what our companies can do and are already doing. So, for example, our companies aren't perfect, but Chinese factory workers want to work for factories that supply to Americans because the standards are higher, the safety standards are better, the environmental standards are better, and the wages are better. So you would much rather work at Foxconn, never mind all the bad press that Foxconn got about the suicides, than you would for a Chinese-run garment factory. So in that sense, all of you, through shareholder activism with Nike and with Apple, are already having a direct impact in people's lives in China and in India as well. Investment, no matter what Trump says, investment back and forth and trade back and forth is really important, and it helps all of us, and maybe we'll do a separate, I'll talk about that a little bit separately. And then the people-to-people exchanges, people poo-poo them because this is not, you know, it's not an immediate impact. It's not like signing a big treaty. But it's so important. The more I have Chinese students in my class at Stanford that are really learning about the American way of life, the more I send my students over to Beida to do a semester there. My seven-year-old is learning Mandarin, as many children here in San Francisco are. All of those little micro actions that we all take are actually very important and prevent us creating a US-USSR type dynamic, which nobody wants.
Okay, just a quick reminder for our radio audience. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is former US State Department official Anya Manuel, who is discussing U.S. relations with China and India. And I'm Lenny Mendoza, your moderator for the program. You can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel. A set of questions around human rights policies and what's going on there, and in particular is a question around what can we do about sex trafficking?
In India?
Yeah.
Human trafficking in India is a big problem. And I think it is not so much a lack of will as a lack of capacity by the Indian authorities to do anything about it. So I talked about the poor and the low caste not being counted. It's hard to know who's being trafficked if you don't know where people are supposed to be, right? It's hard to know who's being trafficked or stop the trafficking if there are too few policemen and if they're paid a pittance. So that's what creates a lot of the problems in India. And there are, you know, there are human rights violations in India. It's not the same level as China, and it's not the same level as a lot of other countries you'd see. But India struggles with it sometimes. And I think the dark side, as much as Modi and his BJP, which is the Hindu Nationalist Party, has been really good for India in an economic sense. The reforms are really starting to take hold. He comes with a dark side. So Modi was, when he was young, a member of what's called the RSS, which is sort of a, some people call it more like the Boy Scouts. The Indian opposition would call it more like the Hitlerjugend. It's sort of a Boy Scout / paramilitary type organization where people get together, they're Hindu nationalists, they march, they all wear the same outfits. And that's the positive side. And the downside is that, you know, sometimes they're not very nice to Muslims and other minorities. And since Modi has come to power, there have been more attacks on Muslims. Not very many, but a man was stoned to death for eating beef. That hadn't happened in a while. So you have these sectarian conflicts in India that arise. They're, frankly, really minor for a country of 1.25 billion people and something like 80 different languages and dialects and many, many religions. But they are there, and they are something to monitor.
Okay. There was a question around how we really should be thinking about the Chinese anti-corruption campaign. Is it a sincere effort to try and crack down on corruption, or is it really just an attempt to get rid of political enemies?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit of both. Because once you unleash forces like this, I talked about Wang Shishan saying it's about the purity of the party. So I don't think that he or she or their allies think that they are just getting rid of their enemies and keeping their friends. You know, the crackdown is too broad for that. 200,000 people have been investigated, right? That's a lot of people. You don't have that many enemies. But the problem is you can denounce people. So you can imagine an official in some province and he has an enemy, and suddenly the enemy talks a lot more publicly about the other guy's corruption, because there's enough corruption to go around, and it just depends on whether or not you're being denounced. So I think the truth, like with many things, lies somewhere in between.
Okay. We'll talk a little bit about economic outlook. There were a set of questions around a lot of the stability and encouragement of what's been happening in Asia is through their economic development. And what happens if they hit a recession in the next while here?
This is a big topic, and we haven't I'm glad that we're talking about it a little bit. A lot of news in our press about China's economy. I think most of our headlines are too negative on China. So there are real problems and real headwinds, and you've probably heard about many of them. They built too many steel plants, too many coal plants, too many cement plants, and too many apartment buildings that no one is living in. So sometimes when I'm over there giving a talk or for a meeting, I'll have the taxi driver drive me around some of these outlying cities, and half of them are empty. They're like ghost towns. Like, who built this? Nobody lives there. So that is a big problem of overcapacity. People just overbuilt. And that sector of the Chinese economy has completely crashed. So when we talk about our manufacturing workers and blue-collar workers suffering, the Chinese manufacturing workers in those sectors are really suffering. Something leaked a month or two ago that China needs to lay off 5 million people just in the coal and steel sectors in the next year or two. That's a lot of people without jobs, right? So sometimes when I hear Trump talk and I see, you know, we're so in a defensive crouch as a nation right now, China is also in a defensive crouch. They're worried about their own future. They're not going gangbusters and out to get us. They're worried. And it's this that makes them worried. But then when you go to Shanghai and Beijing, the malls are full. The service industry is growing at 11% a year. Consumer spending is growing by 1.5 times the rate of the economy, 10, 11, 12% a year. Those are rates that we can only dream of. Right, so there's two Chinese economy, just like in a way there's two American economies. You don't see much of a recession here in Silicon Valley. So that's kind of how you have to see it. And I think I talked to a lot of economists in writing the book. I think the consensus view is right now they're not making 6 or 7%. They're probably more like 4%. But as China ramps up some of its reform trajectory, they're going to get back to 6-7% in the next couple of years. That's kind of where the general consensus is. It's not that their economy is crashing. India has a little bit the opposite story. So it didn't grow as fast as it should have for decades. It was what was disparagingly called the Hindu rate of growth, 4% a year. And that was largely because of tons of red tape, no openness to trade, and the economy was basically closed in. In the early 1990s, the government changed that, and India had its first big boom, really from the late 90s to 2005 or so. Growth at 7, 8, 9% a year. And then it kind of stalled out because the second phase of reforms hadn't really happened. And the Singh government was so out of steam a few years ago that they just couldn't push any of these things through. And that is why Modi was elected by such a landslide. And that is what he's trying to do now. It's hard because just like here, even if you're the prime minister, or in our case the president, you're not all powerful. You have a parliament to answer to. And in India, many of the biggest reforms have to happen at the state level. So Modi wants to do things like make it easier for businesses to buy land to build factories, make environmental clearances faster and more transparent, make it easier to hire and fire workers. A lot of those things the central government doesn't have power over, so it has to happen at the state level, which means it's going to move a little more slowly than we think. In my view, with the Indian economy, it's growing right now at between 7 and 8%. I think they'll be lucky if they get that the next few years. So we're still kind of 6, 7, 8%. Again, that's stuff that we here can only dream of. But yeah.
Okay. Set of questions around protectionism. And feels like we have on the rise a bipartisan view about opposition to free trade and the TPP. What does that mean for the outlook of our relationships? And are we heading into an environment of retreat on that front, and are we in a possibility of trade wars? What's going on there?
Yeah, I'm so glad someone asked the question because I worry about this a lot. This is the first time that you've had both major American national political parties be anti-trade. And there was a lot of talk, especially on the Clinton side, that right now she's anti-TPP, but that's going to turn around if she's elected. It's going to be hard to turn around. She's made a campaign promise to people. And I think TPP is a good agreement. It is agreement that should pass the U.S. Congress, and free trade is just really getting a bad rap right now. But it is what drives our economy. So you hear Trump out there saying that China is raping us and we need to uncouple from the Chinese economy or it's going to bring us down, or his proposal for 45% tariffs. I don't know, last time I checked, if you slap 45% tariffs on a country, they'll probably retaliate, right? And if that happens, our fastest growing export market is closed to us. So just one example, Boeing manufactures all of its planes right here in the U.S. More than a quarter of their planes are sold to China and India alone. So if those markets are closed, they estimate that just Boeing, one company, will lay off tens of thousands of Americans. So it goes a little bit both ways, and I worry that in this rather dramatic campaign season, that voice isn't really being heard in public.
Okay, well, related question. We are sitting in Silicon Valley, the heart of technology and trade, and a deep connection to China and India. Feels like it's as far from here to China and India as it is from here to Washington, D.C. Is there anything that we should be doing in this part of the world to help engage a thoughtful view about U.S. relationship with China and India on this front?
Yeah, oh, I'm so happy someone asked that. Yes, there is, and there's so much we can do because what I talked about in the last question about the protectionism, there are no counter voices. It feels like everyone just wants to lay low right now, even though most of the business folks I talk to are absolutely engaged in trade with China and to a lesser extent with India, and it's a really important part and fast-growing part of their business. That doesn't mean I don't want to be an apologist for China. They are doing a lot of things to our companies that are problematic. They're coddling their national champions. They're making it difficult for us to invest in certain sectors. So is India, by the way. They are putting, trying to have us put technology backdoors. It's a difficult, where there's, you know, there's cyber IP theft. Those things are real issues, and we need to discuss them at the highest level of the government relationship. And by the way, we are. Like, that is always front and center of when Obama goes over and anybody, frankly, across administrations talks to Chinese. But breaking off trade relations just hurts us, frankly, as much as it hurts them.
Okay. Couple more questions. Unfortunately, we're getting close to the end of our time. The recently articulated pivot to Asia in terms of foreign policy is an important statement about what the U.S. says it's intending to do. But what are the tangible things that we should be doing in foreign policy more aggressively to really be an effective move towards the importance of India and China in particular that you articulated in your book?
Mm-hmm. So the pivot to Asia had an unfortunate name, and like many things, and I can say this with all respect since I've worked in the U.S. government, usually our military is faster than anybody else. So the pivot, unfortunately, took on a very military cast, unintentionally so, just because DOD was faster out of the box than the trade negotiators and others. I do think the idea that we need to pay a lot of attention to Asia is important. But we should do it slightly differently, I believe, than what we have been. Right now, we are really at loggerheads with China a lot of the time. We're going to continue to have interests that differ from theirs in particular. So one, we need to pay more attention to India because that is the other great power in Asia. And if anyone's going to help us manage the rise of China, it's the Indians and the Japanese to a lesser extent, but really it's the Indians. And secondly, we need to be really clear about where our lines are and we need to enforce them consistently, which we try, but we sometimes don't do. And it's, you know, it's just the vagaries of being a democracy. So here's an example. We tell the Chinese that the South China Sea isn't their sea, and this nine-dash line that they think they've drawn, we don't accept, and the international community doesn't accept. And so for a while, at the beginning of the Obama administration, we did these freedom of navigation operations where we drove very close to some of these islands. Then we stopped, and then last fall, we started again. If I'm the Chinese military, I think, do they mean it? I mean, I have young children. I'm sure many of you have raised children as well. If you let them cross the line once, bedtime isn't the same bedtime ever again. So we just need to be consistent about what our policies are and enforce them consistently. That's on the negative side. On the positive side, we need to find as many areas of cooperation as we possibly can. And it sounds trite, but it isn't something that happens automatically. So before we negotiated the civilian nuclear deal with India. Clinton had done this big opening and had traveled to India. Bush doubled down with the civilian nuclear deal. And let me tell you, that thing was a bear to negotiate. We were fighting with the Indians about everything. I mean, the amount of hours that we spent in very stifling Delhi conference rooms, but it taught us how to work together and how to work through difficult problems and have a joint project. And it unlocked a lot of cooperation in other areas. And with China, we're just starting that. It's a little harder with China, but the climate change deal I talked about is one example. There are things we can do together. You know, the Chinese have been mostly helpful on North Korea. It's not perfect, but mostly helpful. The trade relationship should be better than it is. There are things we can cooperate on where we're frankly being obstinate. Like, I think it's great that China, with all of its infrastructure investment around the world, has chosen to tie itself into a new international institution that they call the AIIB. They chose to reduce their own power. They could do all this by themselves, but they chose to do it through an international institution. We should join it. Why aren't we joining it? So those are the kinds of things. And then the things I talked about with what businesses can do and what ordinary people can do, we need to learn to cooperate.
Okay, we've unfortunately reached that point in our program where there's only time for one last question, and I'm going to give you a chance to answer that in a way that I'm sure you're already being asked this, which is you are sitting in a room with the new president of the United States, and she or he turns to you and says, we have a chance to reset our relationship with China and India during my term. What are the things that you want to make sure they walk away with to ensure that your brave new world, that's the positive outlook, proceeds?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, some of them I've already mentioned in the last answer. You got to be clear and consistent about the lines, where the lines are, and you need to cooperate wherever we can. I would tell her that we really do need to pay more attention to India. And it sounds silly, but the Indians are a very proud people, and they feel it. And they know that Modi comes to the United States, and it is front page news in every Indian newspaper this week, and it hardly made a blip on the screen here. And I would also say that we need, when I'm talking about cooperating on a government-to-government front, you need a few, really one big project that you do together. Because what happens now, and what happened, and a lot of folks in the Obama administration are my friends, so it's not faulting them. But what happened with the India relationship is they weren't acting up, right? They weren't causing any problems on the world stage. So they get lower level of priority. The countries that scream the loudest tend to get the most attention when you're in the State Department or elsewhere. And instead of having, so what we have with India now is we have 15 little initiatives, and none of them are moving forward very quickly. What we need are one or two things where we really can make a difference for our people. And they can be environmental, they can be a free trade agreement, wouldn't that be great? No one imagines that with India. It could be a whole, you could choose what they are. It doesn't matter so much what they are. It needs to be a joint project. And I would say the same with China. We need to look very, very hard for a positive thing to do together, because right now we are dying death of 1,000 little negative cuts.
That's fantastic. So please join me in thanking Anya Manuel. As a reminder, Anya was the former State Department official, author of this fantastic new book, This Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. We'd also like to thank our audiences here on the radio, here and on radio, television, and the internet. We also wish to remind everyone who's here that Ms. Manuel's new book is for sale right behind us, and she'll be glad to sign a copy for you if you'd like. I'm Lenny Mendoza, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.